Thanks. Thanks for the introduction and the invitation. So, yeah, so I'm going to tell you, I'm actually not strictly speaking working in evolutionary biology, but I will try to maybe link some of the things we are doing to questions which could be or should be interesting for evolution people. And what we work on is really the mechanics of the cell and cell shape and this kind of questions. For those who are wondering why I have two affiliations on everything I write, it's because actually my lab is a joint appointment between the Max Planck Society and the Polish Academy of Sciences. And we are technically based in Germany, but we have a joint appointment with an institute in Warsaw. That's why we have two logos. So the question, like the global questions we're interested in, is really how does the cell define its own shape, and be it in a culture dish or in a tissue. And more specifically, what we are looking at is the actin cortex, which is this layer of actin, myosin, and all kind of proteins which lies under the plasma membrane. So here, this is just a fibroblast in culture where we have stained myosin in green and the membrane in red. And you can already see just in a simple confocal picture that the myosin seems to be nicely under the membrane. And if you take a closer look at the structure, so you've heard about this a little bit last week, for example, in Marie Delattre's talk in C. elegans. This is also a very important structure, the actin cortex. If you take a closer look at that, this is what it looks like. So this is an electron microscopy picture of this cortical layer here. And we look towards the membrane, and what you can see is that there's a lot of filaments which don't seem to have any sort of organized structure. It's kind of a meshwork without any preferential direction. And every now and then, it seems to have a mesh size which is rather well defined. I'll come back to that in a second. And every now and then, there's holes or changes in the meshwork, so that, for example, here, a clathrin coated vesicle can go through inside the cell. And how this happened is completely not understood. So the nice thing about the cortex for people like us is that basically we don't know anything about it. So what we know is pretty much that, okay, there's the membrane. And at the membrane, most likely there's some nucleator, but it's not the most known nucleators of actin. It's not up to three. It's probably a formin, which nucleates actin filaments, which then are cross-linked by some cross-linkers or maybe some motors. And that these motors can make the filaments slide with respect to each other, so this gives the network its contractile property, of which I'm going to speak extensively. And there's a lot of other proteins in there. This is a scary picture. It's actually cheating a bit. This is not the cortical. These are not the cortical proteins. I wish we had a list like that for the cortex. We don't yet. This is just the proteins interacting with actin known from other structures in the cell. But basically, it's a big, complicated meshwork, self-assembled, of lots of proteins which interact together. And we don't quite understand how it's assembled, how it grows, how it's regulated. We hardly know anything. But what's pretty clear is that in the end, you get this nice, smooth layer, which here is in white. This is actin in a dividing cell. Here, this is a migrating cell in a tissue. Actin is in green. So in the end, you get a quite smooth, nice layer of actin, which has very controlled mechanical properties, so that the cell is able, for example, to squeeze precisely in one part and divide, or squeeze preferentially at the back so that it can migrate. So basically, the bottom line message here is that you have this flock of proteins which interact in ways we don't quite understand yet, which form a very regulated and precisely controlled network of actin, which lies under the membrane and is able to contract in a very precise manner, both in time and space. Yeah.
You said it was self-organized.
Yes.
Does that mean you can make cortical actin with these mechanical properties, you can reconstitute that particular activity?
So hopefully. Nobody has done that yet. So Margaret showed a small movie last week. So many labs have been trying to do that for the last 5-6 years. So to reconstitute an actin cortex in a vesicle and see if it would be contractile. Nobody has really succeeded yet, but I guess it's possible. The problem is, I guess, as opposed to, for example, listeria motility, we don't know what are the minimal components. So we don't even know the nucleator here, so it's very hard to... So the cortex in vesicles is grown with up to three, but the cortex in the cell is not up to three dependent, so that's one of the things we're looking into, how it comes about. But I guess that once we know the minimal components, yes, you could, hopefully. And one thing you can do is you can make cell fragments which have contractile properties, so that's sort of an indication that this is probably self-assembled. And it's very well controlled. And just to show you an example of what happens if it's not controlled, so every now and then something may go wrong and the cell loses its sense of polarity. Like these two cells are very clearly polarized because this one has an axis and this one is polarized so that it can move in one direction. And if something wrong happens, sometimes you have this kind of behavior where the cell is obviously not polarized anymore. And this is a cell where what the only thing we did is basically enhance the contractility of the cortex, in that case by removing microtubules. And what it starts doing is starts forming all over the place this kind of round protrusions, of which I'm going to speak a lot further on, which are called blebs.
Is it real-time?
I'm sorry?
It's not real-time, right?
No, it's 25 times accelerated. They grow in about 20 seconds, 10 to 12, even 5 sometimes, depends.
You've treated this cell with narcotics or...?
Yeah. These cells are mucolytic. So this is just a kind of random example of blebbing, but you can have blebbing in many situations. I come back to that. Just narcolazole in these cells seems to increase myosin activity. Well, actually, it doesn't seem. It phosphorylates myosin. If you look at the levels of phosphorylated myosin, it's increased. So the, yeah?
Is it, no, what's the difference between like osteoblasts, which do this exact same thing naturally?
Uh-huh.
What's the functional difference between something like an osteoblast and regular polarized cell?
It's not quite known. I guess it's, so, no, it's not really known. So it's a question of controlling contractility and membrane cortex attachment, especially very precisely, and how it's done is very poorly understood. But I guess I come back to this kind of questions quite a bit. So just the global framework of my lab is, as I was pointing out, on the one hand you have lots of proteins which self-assemble in some network, which has a pretty well-defined structure. And then on the other hand you have the mechanical properties of this network, which allow it to provoke deformations in cells. And what we're trying to understand, so there's been for years and years lots of physicists who have been studying that specifically. So you can take mechanical properties of cells have been measured for a very long time. And then the more biological approach is usually to work on this side, to try to knock down proteins and see what happens in terms of shape and phenotype. And what we are trying to do is really try to understand the interaction between these two. So which of the proteins of the network are actually important for its mechanical properties, and how do you go the other way? Is there any feedback loop? And this is just my kind of evolutionary parenthesis, but if when it comes to the cortex, can everybody see if I write here? So when it comes to the cortex, it seems that its structural properties such as mesh size, thickness, and turnover, to name only a few, are pretty well controlled for a given cell type. So there's this study, this electron microscopy study, for example, compares mesh sizes from this kind of pictures in different cell types, and it can be really different. It can go from 50 to 250 nanometers on average, depending on the cell type. But within a given cell type, this is a number which is pretty nicely centered around a sort of Gaussian distribution. It seems to be the same for thickness, although this is a tricky question because nobody really, it's very thin, it's between 200 and 500 nanometers, so far there's been no good way to measure cortical thickness. That's something us and others are trying to do with like super resolution microscopy nowadays, and hopefully in a year or two from now we'll have more data on that. And when it comes to turnover, this is also something. So you can take a cortex, bleach a zone, and see how long it takes for actin to come back, and this number, which is usually between 20 seconds and 2 minutes, depending on the phase of the cell cycle and the cell type, is also well controlled. So these things are well defined. And then the mechanical properties, which we try to measure, are, for example, tension, of which I will speak much more in the next few minutes, or the viscoelastic properties of the cortex. So that's just two examples, but I guess as many others you could try to measure, seem also to be really well defined within a given cell type. So the cell seems to have ways to control its own mechanical properties and things like cortical tension or cortical thickness. And it's very unlikely that this happens just because you have the right amount of proteins in the right place. And it's much more likely that you have some mechanical feedback loops involved and that there's some mechanosensing of these things. And how this is achieved is something we really have hardly any idea about. And why it's so important is because when a cell is in a tissue, the way this tissue will arrange itself and the way the cells will maybe contract in one place to lead to gastrulation or to lead to global movement of tissues is directly dependent on these things, on things like tension and the viscoelastic properties of cells in a given place and at a given time in development. And these things are very well controlled. And the kind of movements you get in a developing embryo are really the result of coupled interactions between different mechanical properties. So there's a sort of emerging view in biology, which was proposed a very long time ago by Darcy Thompson, who wrote a very beautiful book about that in the 1920s, if I'm correct, where basically what he suggested at that time and what more and more developmental biologists are doing at the moment is consider that the movements and the tissue reorganization you get in development are the result of basically mechanical modules interacting together. And so this sort of, what more and more people are trying to do is to look at evolutionary question from this perspective also. So this, as I will show you for tension, there's many ways at the molecular level to control cortical tension. And maybe it doesn't matter how you do it at the molecular level, maybe the only thing that counts is what happens in the end mechanically. So that gives an evolutionary constraint which is very different from protein interaction, but which is more at the mechanical level. And this is not something I am directly looking into, but I think more and more that this would be something really cool to study. And I honestly don't know much about that, and I don't know if anybody does. But I think the question is interesting. So what I'm going to tell about is a little bit more about cortex mechanics and tension, just to show you that these things really can be regulated at very, very different levels. And then I'm going to give you a somewhat longer introduction about blebbing as such and why we think it's important and where it's involved. And then I'm going to spend the first part of the talk on the importance of blebs and cortex mechanics in cell division. And then, depending on the time and energy, I'll hopefully get a little bit into blebbing in migration. So let's start with the mechanical properties. So I'm going to focus for the rest of my talk in terms of mechanical properties on cortex tension, which I'm going to define a bit better now. Again, there's many other ones which we haven't looked closely at, and I really think that viscoelastic properties, how they are regulated, is something which should be looked at with more attention, and hopefully we'll get into that someday. But so far we've been mainly focusing on tension. So what is tension? So the physicist's view on tension is kind of, if you take a spherical cell like this one, which has a cortex of actin and myosin, so actin and myosin are in red, it's a very schematic representation, and if you zoom on a part of this cortex, this is what it looks like. You have the membrane, and then you have this meshwork of actin and myosin under the membrane, which is cross-linked with a lot of red myosin motors here, which has a certain thickness, which is set in some way, we don't quite know how, but it is. And what tension is basically how strong each little piece of network is being pulled on by the neighbors. And if you put a very basic model on that, what this gives you is something like this, where tension would be the product of the active stress in the network, which depends on, so the delta mu here, so that's models from Jacques and Jean-François. Delta mu here is the chemical energy released by one step of myosin. And you have to multiply this by a coefficient, which includes how many myosins you have, how they are organized, mini filaments, I don't know how many, we don't quite know how they are organized, so this is an empiric coefficient. And it also will depend on the thickness of the network, because if you have a thicker network, it's just, for the same stress, it's just going to be more contracted. So this is what tension is in a spherical cell. In a spread cell, it's much more complicated to define, and actually I'm not sure we really know how to do that. But in a spherical cell, it's easy to define it this way. And one important thing it does is if you have a cell like this, with a cortex under certain tension, it's going to exert a hydrostatic pressure on the inside of the cell, and this pressure will be given by Laplace law, which tells you that the difference of pressure between the inside and the outside is going to be 2 times the tension over the radius. And that's something we can discuss further after, because there's interesting implication of that to how the cell volume is defined. But I don't really want to get into that right now. So we can measure tension. So we are mainly an experimentalist lab. We collaborate a lot with theorists, but in the lab we really mainly do experiments. So we designed a setup to measure tension, which was first developed by Evan Evans in the late 70s. And the way to do it is basically you have a pipette, which is attached to some kind of pressure controller, in which you aspirate a cell until you get a half a sphere inside the pipette. So this is what it looks like. And in that case, you can apply Laplace law on this side and on that side. And if you do this on both sides, you get rid of the intracellular pressure, which is the one you don't know. And in that way, you get an expression for tension, which is directly related to the pressure inside the pipette. Yeah?
What reasons do you have to believe that the cortex is a shearless medium? Because I know that formula only works for sure.
So you have to go very, very slowly. So there's a couple of controls you have to do. If you go faster, it doesn't behave like this as well. So what we at all. So what we do is we increase pressure like by 10 pascals every minute. So it's very, very slow aspiration. And we've checked for a couple of things. So one thing you have to check is that if you increase this pressure slightly, your cell is going to flow inside slowly, behave like a sort of viscous fluid. And this is more or less what happens, except the nucleus blocks at some point. And again, this depends on how fast you go. But if you go slowly enough, it's this, the numbers you find here don't depend on the radius of the pipette and don't depend too much on the step of pressure you impose. But if you go very fast, you have elastic properties, which we don't want to consider in that case. So, yeah. And it doesn't work for all cell types. But it works very well for neutrophils, for dictyostelium, for this kind of cells. Yeah, but all this, that's the problem, actually. I think one other thing I forgot to mention is one of the reasons we know so little about how these things are controlled is because they are so hard to measure. Because it's very hard to be sure that you actually measure tension and nothing else. And when it comes to viscoelastic properties, it's even worse. And this is an isolated cell in a dish, but if you look at cells in tissue, then it's even then there's really hardly anything you can do except cutting and see how things relax. That's the only thing that has been done so far, pretty much. So if you use that method, whatever it's worth, you actually get quite well-defined numbers for tension. So this is just one example to check that works. So these are our favorite fibroblasts. Now we work more with another. So this is L9-9 fibroblasts. Now we work more with HeLa cells. So just to be honest with you, these are standard errors. So if I put deviations, they would be higher than this. However, you can, all these numbers, so except these three, all these are statistically different from each other. And what you see that for control cells, you have a rather well-defined tension around 400 piconewton per micrometer. So that's 10 to the minus 6 newton per meter, which is the usual order of magnitude you find for tensions. Dictyostelium is about 10 times higher than this, and neutrophils are about 10 times lower. But this is like from 40 to 4,000 piconewtons per micrometer is the kind of tensions you find for cells. And this number, so for fibroblasts in culture, is usually well defined. And if you take primary cells from a fish, for example, this is going to depend on the cell type very clearly. Now, if you block myosin activity, which is the first thing to do, so that has been shown for other cells before, if you block myosin activity with different drugs, which is what we do here, you get a decreased tension. And if you increase myosin activity, for example, with the constitutively active version of Rho, which is an activator of myosin and many other things in the cell, you get a tension which is about four times higher than under control conditions. Yeah?
Why do you get an attention?
What do you mean?
If you look at very low, so if you go very slowly when you aspirate, I believe that it behaves like a fluid, but then if you don't have any tension due to myosin,
but you do, okay, you don't block it completely. You mean with the blebbistatin?
Yeah.
You don't, so that's a good question. What this basically means is that myosin 2 is not the only thing putting tension in that system. And there's five myosin 1s which localize to the cortex.
Is it that, or is it that blebbistatin never completely...
I think it's that, because in HeLa cells you drop it by 90% with blebbistatin. So you get only 10% in the end. And if you remove actin, it's actually in the next slide I can show you.
Sorry, even if it's 10%, it can be enough to give you huge force.
Yeah, but the 10%, so this is about that. So if you put cytokalasin, which just depolymerizes actin, this is about the tension of a red blood cell. And these cells, even if you get rid of actin, they have spectrin at the membrane. So you have a tension which is non-zero, which is not going to be a pure lipid bilayer, because you probably always have something. Now, in this case, why... I guess in this case it's because it's not the only tension generator in these cells. But
so you would say the same thing for stress fibers, because I was like in Benoit-Ladoux's experiment. Mm. If you use blebbistatin, it just reduces the contractile force by a factor of 2, which is.
I don't know for stress fibers, because stress fibers are. I'm not sure. I don't know that they contain any myosin 1 or other motors. Because for the cortex, we know there's eight myosin motors in there. So there's two different myosin 2, five myosin 1, and one myosin 18, whatever it does. So myosin 1s attach the cortex to the membrane, so it's different. It's not clear if they generate any tension at all. And that's something we're looking into but haven't really done so far. But yeah, that's one of the projects we have, is really to understand how tension is regulated. And this is just a parenthesis for the physicists, is that basically what this number tells you is that the extra hydrostatic pressure in the cell is 100 pascals, so it's 100 pascals higher than in the medium, which is very small compared to the osmotic pressure of the medium, and that's something which we started discussing with Jack what that actually means. But I think what that means is that tension is not going to define the volume much. It's all going to be osmotic pressure dependent.
So you're saying that in most cases you're not surface area limited in terms of your volume, that you're actually sort of floppy, right?
Yes, and that's also probably true because you always can get blebs whatever you do, unless you do something really drastic. So it seems there's some surface available, and where it comes from, nobody knows. Maybe Cavirle, maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm. There seems to be some membrane reservoirs, and what they are is, yeah.
The membrane tension is very, very small.
The pure bare membrane. So I don't want to say anything completely wrong, but as far as I remember, it's like four, the order of magnitude. Maybe even lower, actually. But Jacques, do you know?
No, I would say like a few percent of the total tension.
Yeah. But like a lipid bilayer, I don't know. But we never get that in cells because I think you always have the spectrin. Now, we didn't try to knock down spectrin, so we should, just to see. And just to tell you, it does not only depend on myosins again. We started doing that. We do this more extensively now. Sorry, that's the slide. I don't want to draw you under protein names, but this is just two of them. So these are, whatever they do, these cofilin and gelsolin, for those who are not into actin, are two proteins which regulate actin turnover. And if you remove them, what we expect is to get a thicker cortex, because both of them limit actin polymerization. So again, I don't know if we get a thicker cortex because we have no way to measure that so far. But if you remove them, in both cases, you increase, so this is the control tension, you increase tension quite significantly. And this is completely myosin independent. So you can mess up with tension by touching things which have nothing to do with myosin, which brings me back to that point here, that the regulation of that can be regulated from many different directions. And if what counts for the cell in the end is to get the right tension, it seems to have many different ways to compensate for small changes in myosin activity or whatever would change, which is poorly understood. Now I'm going to go into blebbing. So why we're interested in blebbing? Well, because blebs have been thought for a long time, and we think it's true, that they result basically from contractility of the cortex. So for those of you who have, so maybe I'll show you the bleb life cycle first. So for those of you who have never heard about them, what they are basically is they are spherical membrane protrusions which occur in many different physiological situations, and they seem to result directly from hydrostatic pressure inside the cell. So the way that works is if you have a huge cell here, and this is a zoom on a part of the membrane with an actin cortex in red, some motors in there which are in green, and some yellow dots which attach the cortex to the membrane. So if you have a kind of cortex under tension which exerts a hydrostatic pressure inside the cell, as long as the membrane is tightly coupled to the cortex, and as long as the pressure is not too high, everything's fine, you have a nice spherical cell. But then if locally, for whatever reason, for example, these yellow dots let go or just segregate, and you have a region where you have less of them, so the attachment between cortex and membrane is released locally, then there's all the chances that this hydrostatic pressure inside due to cortical contractility is going to lead to the growth of a kind of blister, which is called a bleb in the literature, which initially is just a bubble of membrane. And you would have the same if you locally made a hole in the cortex. And I'll show you an experiment in a second where we do exactly that. So you have this bubble of membrane, which is purely due to hydrostatic pressure inside the cell, which initially has no actin. It seems to only have some spectrins. And then at some point, actin repolymerizes at the surface of the bleb, and the bleb retracts. So this is quite common, and it's been thought for a very... So they've been observed like ages ago in the 19th century. There's papers on amoeba migration, which document them very, very clearly. What hadn't been actually tested is that this is really the way that they really grow purely because of hydrostatic pressure. And one experiment which indicates that this is indeed the case is the following one, where what we do is we take a cell and we locally shoot a hole in the cortex. So we use a pulsed laser for that, which has it's not a too strong laser. For those who are familiar with laser ablation, it's much, much softer than what people usually use in embryos. And what we do is we make a hole in the cortex locally, and this immediately leads. So this is a zoom on a cell, the green is actin again. This immediately leads to the growth of a bleb, which if we wait longer, so this is 30 seconds, if we wait like a few minutes, it's going to retract after some time. So that suggests that the growth of this thing is indeed directly resulting from pressure and not from some further regulation delivery of membrane, because it's just too fast. You cannot really have exocytosis on a 2 seconds time scale. You could have unfolding of whatever docked membrane there would be under the membrane, but it's probably not further regulated.
So if some movement, so if you do the ablation and then this hole you have in the cortex is increasing in size, is that due to like the physical movement of the cortex, or is this due to like some turnover phenomenon, you know, depolarization of the cortex, or
so it's probably a bit of both. The turnover in this situation is like 20, 30 seconds, the half-time. So on the first 30 seconds, it's probably just real pure elastic limited opening, viscoelastic limited opening. And that's something, I was not going to show that, but we can discuss this at some point. That's something we've done that with cells with different tensions and see how much the opening depends on tension, and it does depend on tension, and it can be fitted with the model that Jean-François and Guillaume Salbre did at the Curie Institute. Yeah.
Did you say you know how big the hole you're blowing the cortex is, or no?
We know what the laser spot is. It's about 0.6 micron. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we take for the nominal value of what we...
Okay. And the pressure is more due to the osmotic imbalance, or it's actually due to the contractility of the network and pressing on
the... We think it's contractility, because if we drop tension to half its value, we don't get any bleb when you do that. So there's a threshold.
But that mechanical threshold, wait, I guess I'm not sure how that tells you where the pressure comes from.
Well, it tells you it depends on active tension. Uh-huh. And another thing we did, so we have the size of these blades as a function of tension, which gives you a curve, which is like this. So nothing, then. And you can actually fit it pretty reasonably with the model, and if you add volume changes, so if you have volume conservation, it fits rather reasonably. If you add volume changes, you cannot fit it properly anymore. Okay. So whatever that's worth. But
okay. So that leaves you with contractility.
Exactly. So that's the argument we have to say that this is purely contractility driven. But in real cells, which bleb in real life, it's of course possible that there's part of the nucleation mechanism which is due to some osmotic effects, which would be, it's an interesting hypothesis for migration. Because there seems to be more aquaporins at the front of migrating cells, and yeah, maybe it has something to do with that. And just a little parenthesis on bleb size. So this is a cool experiment because we can induce them wherever we want, and then we can track the size of the bleb and measure the size of the bleb, and so we've done that for different tensions. I'm not going to go into that, but...
The membrane comes from flow from the adjoining region?
So the membrane, I don't know. We've been trying very hard to look at where it comes from. It's very hard to look at flows of membrane because everything seems to stick to the cortex one way or another. So I don't know. It doesn't seem, we tried to block exocytosis, it doesn't seem to change anything, so that's the only indication I have.
What sets the scale of the size? Why doesn't it expand more?
What's the scale of?
The size of the...
Of the hole?
Yeah.
It gets up to, so that's 2 microns, so it gets...
What sets that scale?
What sets that scale? So in the model, it's the elasticity of the cortex and the pressure you have inside the cell, and elastic properties of the inside also, because they dissipate pressure.
Is there any known function of blebs, or is it just a pathology?
No, there's quite, I come into that in a second. There's actually lots of known, And so the only size experiment I wanted to show you is this one. So you can play around with this experiment and do 2 blebs. And you can make one and then another one very shortly after, close or far away from the first bleb, or you can wait and make the second one much later. And so if you wait, this is the ratio of the volume of the second one to the first. If you wait, you get that. You get the size of the bleb is more or less equal to the size of the first one. So these are biological data. That's usually what they look like. They are quite spread. And if you do them immediately one after the other, then you see that on average, the size of the second bleb is about 25% smaller than the size of the first one, which is an indication that you did release some pressure. So if you make one bleb and then the second will be smaller. And it's not membrane limited, because if we ablate at the front of a growing bleb, it grows even bigger. So it seems to indicate that these are pressure-driven and they release pressure.
Does it depend on where the blebs are located relative to each other?
No, so that's a cool thing, yeah. If you do this here or here, on average it's exactly the same. It's actually scarily exactly the same, because it's 0.75, 0.76. which was quite surprising. So no, it on this time scale, so this is a 4 seconds difference. I know why you asked that question. So there's been a lot of discussion whether pressure equilibrates. So there's a very nice paper from the Michison lab where they suggest that pressure doesn't equilibrate in cells on timescales comparable to the growth speed of a bleb. So in our hands, in these cells, it doesn't seem to be the case. So it seems to equilibrate quite fast.
Or the size of the cell is much smaller than it is.
It's not much smaller. This is 15 microns diameter, and their cells, yeah. Yeah. But the M2 cells, they bleb all over the place all the time, so they may be different. It's
square data point there? You have some funny squares?
This is the average and standard. These squares?
Yeah.
This is just the average. And so these are the data points. This is the average and the standard error. Okay, so a bit about blebs.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So the time scale of the growth of the bleb, I guess going back to Dan's question, kind of has to be, I mean, presumably you blow this hole and there's some like stretch in the cortical network and it kind of relieves when the hole gets open and like shrinks a little bit. So first off, can you sense that shrinking of the cell at all? Because obviously on that instantaneous time scale, the total volume of the cell must be probably conserved.
Yeah.
And then after that, any kind of further growth must actually be active, like a movement of the cortex driven by myosin. So can you like see any of that, or?
So like cell body volume changes.
Or can you like do some kind of weird ATP experiment where you stop, or do something that stops myosin and see like the growth stop, or?
So if you stop myosin, you could stop the growth pretty immediately. So if you put blebbistatin, you do. Now the volume changes. The problem is the volume is like 6% of the cell volume. Uh-huh. And with any type of microscopy we use, we cannot detect that. There are some fancy ways to do that, but not we haven't tried. We have a 10% error on the volume, so yeah,
okay.
Cannot really say.
Do you know if the cortical tension away from the blood is changing when you lose the blood?
You mean here? Yeah, oh, you mean if we had tried to ablate in a pipette, for example? Okay. We want to do that, we haven't done that yet. That would be very nice. And that.
Well, I didn't get the when did you say?
Oh, I want to know if you change the cortical tension when you reduce the blood. Because you could be redistributing the same number of myosin, so it goes up every place else, or you could be inducing some regulation.
What we have checked is that we don't do anything active. So like we looked at what was obvious. We looked at the myosin doesn't seem to increase, like reactivity doesn't increase, like all these things seem to be. We hope we have the same cortex before and after. So I don't think it changes actively. Now, what we want to do is do this experiment with having the cell aspirated in a pipette here and see what happens inside the pipette. And that would be also a way to measure how much pressure we release by the growth of this thing. So now I'm going to go into blebs and what they are good for and why they've been ignored for a long time. So in the last maybe 20 to 30 years, blebs happen to have a very bad reputation among cell biologists and to some extent developmental biologists. And the reason for that is that they are very, very dramatic and clear in apoptotic cells. So it is true apoptotic cells look like that. For those of you who ever looked at a dying cell, you know it blebs all over the place. And these are really blebs which look like those I've shown you. They're dynamic, they grow, retract, at least in the early stages of apoptosis. And because of that, in cell biology, whenever you saw blebbing, you tried to pretend you don't see it, to be honest. This is what happened in the end. Or you tried to look at it. It doesn't happen in any type of condition. So people tried to sort of ignore them.
So, what is this F bleb? I mean, all of the other blebs are more spherical.
Oh, this is fixed.
In the F, it's fixed. Okay.
I wouldn't trust that. This is electron microscopy fixed. So the shape, I wouldn't trust. But now what's been shown for apoptosis is that actually this apoptotic blebbing, there's three groups who have worked on that, and they have shown, I should have put the references, but what they have shown is this thing works, kind of, is that this apoptotic blebbing totally depends on the activity of myosin. So what happens is that when a cell enters apoptosis, there are different pathways, whatever they are, which trigger overactivation of myosin activity via the classical myosin kinases, which are myosin light chain kinase and ROCK, which are the two classical myosin activators in the literature. And these altogether or separately, depending on the type of apoptosis you're looking at, they get overactive. So myosin gets hyperactive in apoptosis. And if you block these things, then apoptotic cells don't bleb anymore and the cells still die. So it means, first of all, you can die without blebs. It also means that blebs per se don't cause apoptosis. And what they are good for, well, this, certainly should be good for something, since these cells bleb all the time. And what's been suggested is that they may help. So what happens to an apoptotic cell is that the DNA gets fragmented, and then it gets sort of into little pieces of cell, and when the cell falls apart. And blebbing may help doing that. So that's a suggestion of what they are good for. But by no means does it mean that blebs equal to apoptosis.
Yes? You said that there were eight different types of myosins in this, in the cortical?
Yeah, in HeLa cells.
So when you talk about myosin hyperactive, is it one of those?
It's usually myosin 2. And there's two types of myosin 2, and they don't have the same, they don't seem to behave the same way at all, but let's group them for now into myosin 2.
And what does blepistatin do across?
It blocks myosin 2, only, supposedly only.
And across how many different species?
No, it's okay. No, it's been checked that people, they looked into myosin 1 activity, it doesn't block myosin 1 activity, and both myosin 2A and 2B.
But across how many different species will this kind of
So as far as I know, it doesn't work in Drosophila, but in all mammalian cells, it works for sure. And now I don't know about things like yeast. I think it works. Although I don't know, actually. I don't know.
What's the difference between the two types of myosin?
So they don't have the... There's there's myosin 2A and B. So what's different is the heavy chain. And they have myosin, you know, it's made, there's one heavy chain and two regulatory light chains and two essential chains. And so the heavy chain is the core of the protein, and it's structurally different, and physically what it does, right, the duty ratio is very different. Like, if I'm not wrong, 2B is much, much longer, stays much longer stuck to actin than 2A. And in our hands, if we knock down 2A if we knock down 2A, we reduce HeLa tension by 90%, so cortical tension. And if we knock down 2B, we don't change anything to tension. So it doesn't mean it doesn't do anything, but it may not do anything to tension. And they have slightly different localization in migrating cells. And in dividing cells, I don't know, we haven't looked yet. But in migrating cells, this has been shown previously.
Sorry, I'm going, forgetting about the apoptosis for a second. In cell division, you see blood in all.
Yeah, I come to that. Okay. So
I wanted to know the function.
Pretty much now. I hope to show you the function in the rest of the talk. So yes, dividing cells bleb a lot and pretty much everywhere. So this is a movie of a cell in culture, but actually it happens in vivo. If they have neighbors all over the place, they don't bleb. But if they have some space, usually a dividing cell will start forming blebs all over at the poles. It's unclear what this is good for. It's been suggested by Trinkels and now by the Mitchison lab that maybe this helps releasing membrane, because the cell, when it cleaves, it has to respread, so it needs to liberate a lot of membrane at the poles, so maybe this blebbing somehow helps the cell releasing membrane. We think it may do something else. I come to that. And just to show you that this is not a new thing people have just figured out recently, this is a quotation from a paper from 1922. They had nice titles at the time, so Observation of Changes in Living Cells During Growth and Division. It's about 52 pages. And what you have at some place, in like one little paragraph in there, this is a description of what happens in anaphase, and so you have very interesting changes. Small balloons of cytoplasm project from the surface of the cell, remain for a few seconds, and then collapse. And this is basically blebs. So that's one. There's many, many other papers in these years. Then it's been discussed again in cytokinesis in the 40s, in the 50s, and then people somehow forgot about it when apoptosis became a major field of research.
So does it need to have a function? It could be just
unavoidable. No, it doesn't. But I show you that we think it actually has one. But it could be just, okay, for a long time, we and Jacques and many people thought that maybe it's just a side effect, because the dividing cell has a high tension, and so maybe it's just a side effect of high tension.
But then we should see it in all dividing cells. I've never seen a picture like this before. In the past 8 weeks of this meeting, any cell that was divided.
Yeah, if you want to show, I could show you movies where it doesn't happen if I wanted to.
It's just mammalian, it happens in this type of mammalian cell. That doesn't mean that it's...
It happens in any cell division I've looked at, in some percentage of the cell it happens.
In any cell division?
In HeLa cells, in L929 cells. zebrafish progenitor cells inside a developing embryo bleb when they divide. And Dictyostelium does, yes?
So you see it in isolated cells, or you see it also in a cell?
Also in tissue. also in tissue. Except that, so it's a very transient thing. So in metaphase, it never ever happens except when something goes really wrong. So it really, in anaphase, it's about during about 10 minutes, and if you don't pay attention, you're not going to see it. But this is, so most people working in like cell biology of division have seen them. Now I've come to migrations, even worse.
All these cells come from multicellular organisms?
Yes, so now I don't know, yeah, I don't know about unicellular. And usually things which have a shell or anything hard at the membrane, they don't live.
So I thought you just said you've seen dicty?
I think so, but I'm not clear-cut sure about dicty. I'm sure in tissues, in Drosophila, in tissues, in mouse developing tissues, it also happens. Like dividing neurogenic cells in mouse developing embryos, they seem to bleb when they divide.
In epithelial tissues?
Yeah, so in epithelial tissues, if a cell is like this, if it has a... So in epithelium, usually, you know, it would look like you have cells which form whatever hexagons. And then when they divide, they round up. And maybe it would bleb at the top, but that's not usually where you look. But if it has neighbors all over the place, it will not bleb. Now, in zebrafish, I have one movie I can show you later when there's a tissue moving this way and this cell in the bag is alone, and it divides. And here it's bleb.
You feel it off now.
No, that's migrating, but that's pretty much the same. So now bleb in migration, that's another situation where people have observed blebs. And this was more known. This was less kind of ignored. So this has been observed a lot in amoeba. Like my amoeba proteus moves pretty much like that under some conditions. Dicty can move like this, depends where, what culture medium you put it into. And inside embryos, these are observations. So in the 40s, there was a German guy called Holtfretter who looked at migrating cells inside developing Xenopus and all kind of other embryos. And he's seen a lot of like bubbly, it was called bubbles, hyaline caps, blisters, whatever, blebs sometimes. Sometimes pseudopods, so pseudopod is the kind of name you give to it when you don't want to call it bleb. or when you didn't look at actin and you're not sure what it is, that's also fine. And so if you look at cells migrating inside embryos, quite often they look like that. Not always, by no means always. There are migration with amelipodia also in embryos. But quite often you see this. So this is some cells which are called deep cells, I think because they are deep inside the embryo. And they move over the yolk. So this huge structure here is the yolk. It has some nuclei. And these cells, as you see, they clearly don't make lamellipodia, but this kind of bubbly structure at the front. And this is a recent movie, but these cells have been studied extensively by a guy called Trinkaus in the 70s. And he's made a very nice paper with a clear classification of the different types of protrusions these cells make. And he's classified blebs, which he also called, I think, lobopodia or pseudopodia, but also blebs, lamellipodia and philopodia. And I come back to that later on. Yeah?
Does anyone look for adhesion complexes in these blebs?
No, and that's a very, yeah, we want to do that. Okay. The thing is, lamellipodia are close to the surface when they're on a dish, so it's very easy to look for small dots of something. Mm-hmm. But if it's a sphere, it's much harder to be sure that you don't miss them. It seems to be cadherin dependent, though, this type of migration. But And this is something we're studying. So this is the migration of a tissue inside zebrafish. We do this in collaboration with the Heisenberg lab. And these cells, so again, actin is in green, I should have written this, membrane is in red, and I come to that extensively later, but what you can see is that they do form blebs at the front, on top of lamellipodia and philopodia, so they form everything together. So blebbing in migration, this is a field which is completely exploding right now, because it happens so that cancer cells can do that as well. So if you try to stop cancer cells from migrating with lamellipodia, quite some types can switch to blebbing migration and escape the treatment in that way. So this is one reason why people get very excited about that at the moment. So just to summarize this kind of bleb introduction, so there are blebs in apoptosis. They may help forming apoptotic bodies, but it's not quite clear. There are blebs, I didn't mention that, in cell spreading. And like if you put a cell on a surface, the first adherent cell, so detach it, put it on a surface, the first thing it will do is bleb, and then this bleb will spread into lamellipodia. And it's been suggested that this may maybe allow the cell to explore the environment in a sort of fast and not very costly way. So one thing people have suggested is that blebs may be cheaper energetically, because the only thing you need is to detach membrane from the cortex, because the pressure is there already. So maybe it was a kind of evolutionary, more primitive type of protrusion than the lamellipodium, which is much more fancy and regulated and mechanosensing and all kind of features it has. But this is just speculation. Now, there are blebs in cell division, I come to that in a second. There are also blebs in some types of viruses can trigger blebbing, and this somehow helps them getting inside the cell. This is a new finding from the Helenius lab last year, or 2 years ago. We don't quite know how that works. And there's a lot of blebbing in cell migration, and I hope to come into that if you're patient with me and have some energy left. And this is a field which is really, people are having more and more interest into that, and like I think a clear sign of that is that in 2008 there were two reviews on blebbing in migration. And the last mention of blebbing in migration before was like in a review was in 1970 something. So this is really a new old topic at the moment. Okay. So
blackboard lunch